It's Tuned To Yesterday, bringing you shows from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Welcome to an hour of true history. Later on, we'll hear the story of the Constitution in the American Trail series and another story from Our Americana on Behind the Scene with Knox Manning. But right now, it's Mr. President from May 9th, 1948 on NBC. Edward Arnold stars as Mr. President with Betty Lou Gerson as Secretary Sarah.
I am weary of the game, yet I don't know how I could live out of it. I don't love slight, neglect, contempt, disgrace, nor insult more than others.
Mr. President, starring Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's Edward Arnold. Mr. President, at home in the White House, the elected leader of our people, our fellow citizen and neighbor. These are little-known stories of the men who have lived in the White House. Dramatic, exciting events in their lives that you and I so rarely hear. True human stories of Mr. President.
We'll bring you Edward Arnold as Mr. President in just a moment. But first, let's take a look at the men who have lived at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., one of the most famous residences in the world. The men who live there are tenants with a four-year lease, our presidents. A national election held once every 4 years makes a man a president. But what makes a president a man? Well, it's the little things he brings to his job. His habits, opinions, hobbies, his moods across the breakfast table. There's a human side to the highest office in the land. And you'll find it in the story of Woodrow Wilson's old-fashioned typewriter and Teddy Roosevelt's Indian clubs. This sort of personal history reveals the man. And that's what our Mr. President series tries to present. And now, another chapter in little-known White House history. Today's story of Mr. President.
Story that happened to the president a few years ago. Listen closely and see if you can tell who the president was. It was almost time for the president to leave for his cabinet meeting, but he sat slumped in a chair without moving. His wife watched him anxiously.
Dear, you really must go or you'll be late.
Yes, yes, I suppose you're right.
Is something wrong?
Not something, my dear, everything.
Well, now don't be discouraged. You'll get things straightened out.
Every place I look is trouble. Trouble here at the Capitol, trouble in the surrounding states, trouble with the cabinet, trouble abroad.
Has anything new happened to the cabinet?
No, but it's certainly obvious that most of them have no use for me or my policies.
Then why don't you discharge them and appoint a new cabinet?
My dear, the former president found them good men. I'm sure the country as a whole would feel that I had no right to dismiss them. And perhaps I am the one at fault.
You're not at fault. The trouble with your cabinet is that instead of taking their instructions from you, they're taking them from someone else, and you know who as well as I.
I know, but I don't know what to do about it.
Well, surely a president has a right to a cabinet he can work with.
My dear, sometimes I think a president has no rights. And on top of everything else, the situation abroad has been nearly crazy. Neither France nor England has any respect for this country. Look at this last episode. France insists that we recall our representative. And then when we do recall him and send another man, they refuse to let him stay on French soil. They're going out of their way to be insulting.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
I don't know. I suggested to the cabinet that we appoint 3 envoys to investigate the problem with France. But Walcott, the Secretary of the Treasury, seemed to feel that that would mean a complete break in the cabinet.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know seems to be the only answer I can make to any question lately. Well, I guess I'd better get to that cabinet meeting.
Will you be home afterwards?
No, no. Afterwards, I think I'll see what happens when you beard a lion in his den. Mr. Hamilton?
Well, this is a surprise, Mr. President. Come in, sit down.
I'm not here officially,
and no one knows I've come.
I've been expecting to hear from you.
Oh, have you?
It was inevitable. However, it didn't occur to me that you would come to me.
I haven't come to you, Mr. Hamilton, not in the way you imply. I came because I wanted to find out if there was any possibility of peace between us.
There must be peace, Mr. President. I am head of your party. There must be perfect peace.
Oh, so now you've elected to call yourself head of the party.
I think you will find there is no doubt about my holding that position, Mr. President. And as head of the party, I expect to run the country.
You do?
Yes. Through you.
Through me? Your impudence is astounding, sir.
This is the beginning of an era, Mr. President. An era of politics.
Politics?
Yes. In the future, political parties are going to elect the presidents in this country, and those parties are going to set the rules of the administration.
Well, Mr. Hamilton, I dare say if we are about to enter on an era of politics, the president can play them as well as anyone else. You know, we have fought on a good many issues, but never until today did I feel that you considered me a fool, Mr. Hamilton.
Why do you say that, sir?
Do you seriously think that you're going to run my administration?
Mr. President, you wanted to send 3 envoys to France, and you wanted to ask Congress to increase the size of the army and the navy. The cabinet opposed your wish. Do you still want to do it?
Yes, why?
Perhaps I can persuade the cabinet to change their minds.
Can you?
Shall I?
Yes. I should very much like to see if you can.
Mr. President, after further reflection, the cabinet is in accord with your former suggestion about sending 3 envoys to France, and recommends, too, that you ask Congress to increase the size of the army and of the navy. We also suggest that a federal property tax be imposed to pay for these increases.
Mr. President, is that you chopping wood?
Don't tell anyone.
We have plenty of wood.
I know, but I wanted to do some thinking.
Who are you mad at?
Oh, you could tell I was mad, huh?
Well, it doesn't take a very bright woman to look at the way you've splintered that log and know you're mad.
Oh, it's the cabinet, the cabinet. I'm determined to keep my temper with them and try to work the situation out.
I wouldn't trust Pickering, Walcott, and McHenry as far as I could throw them.
Well, they've always been known as honest men. I suppose they have a right to listen to Mr. Hamilton if they believe he's right. It angers me that they do, but at the same time, I know it's their right. And if I dismiss them, I may be starting a very dangerous precedent. Well, we'll see what happens in the next few months.
You're looking tired, dear. You're working too hard.
I am tired, but one of your dinners will do wonders for me, my dear.
These were the years we were going to sit by the fire and dream. Remember? These were the years when you were to retire. We were going to watch our children and our grandchildren and the country grow and develop. And just look at us.
You know, you're prettier today than the day I married you.
Get along with you now.
Have you ever been sorry?
That I married you?
Mm-hmm.
Not 1 hour of one single day. They've been rich years.
Yes, but not in dollars.
In the things that dollars can't buy. In adventure, companionship, in love. In the things we've lost and suffered over together. In the things we've lost over and remembered. In the dreams we've dreamed for the joy of dreaming.
You know, someday we will have that fire. We'll sit there and watch the sun go down behind the rim of the hill. And the cabinets and the troubles with France and England and politics will all be in the past. And the only things we will talk about will be the weather, the stars, and each other. How does that sound to you?
Unspeakably dull.
Oh, good. This woman, is there no pleasing you?
There is, but that's not the way to do it. Come on in now. It's almost dinner time.
Do you know the word we received from France today?
No.
Well, they've declared that all Americans caught serving on British ships are to be considered pirates.
No.
Yes.
What are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to prepare for war and do everything I can to keep the peace. The first thing that has to be done is to appoint the envoys we want to send to France. Gentlemen of the cabinet,
I would suggest that the envoys appointed to France be General Pinckney, John Marshall, and Elbridge Gerry.
Mr. President, Gerry's not a good party member.
Well, gentlemen, I believe that one member of the group should be appointed from the opposition.
But that's ridiculous.
But not Mr. President, this is an important situation that should be trusted only to loyal members of the party.
After all, we have no influence over Gerry. Quite the contrary.
This situation is not the responsibility of the opposition, but of the party in power. Why, we wouldn't know where we stood for a moment with Gerry.
Well, gentlemen, who would you suggest that I recommend to Congress in place of Mr. Gerry?
I would suggest Francis Dana.
Ah, yes. You couldn't get a better man.
Very well, gentlemen. I shall recommend Mr. Dana.
Why did you give in on Mr. Gerry, dear?
Because right now I want to do all I can to get along with the cabinet. I don't want to appear arbitrary.
Well, they certainly appear arbitrary.
Well, that's all right, as long as I don't appear that way. Besides, I had a feeling I would get my way anyhow. Francis Dana declined the appointment, and I was sure he would, and so...
So?
So I reappointed Gerry anyhow.
You know, if I were that cabinet, I'd watch you mighty carefully from now on.
Well, they aren't watching me very closely at all. I believe they think I'm licked. They think I'm eating out of their hands.
Well, one of the best ways I can think of to lose a hand is to let you eat out of it. When does the commission sail for France?
Very shortly.
Do you think Talleyrand will receive them?
Well, he's pretty tricky. It's hard to say.
Did Congress pass the federal tax to pay for the increases in the Army and the Navy?
Yes, they did.
Wonder how the people are going to like that.
The cabinet thought it was a good idea.
I know, but what about the people?
I imagine the people will let us know how they feel about it in very short order.
Oh, dear, I wish we could go to Quincy for a few weeks. You need a rest.
Well, we'll see the commission off to France, and we'll see what develops. Maybe one of these years we will get that vacation.
Beautiful afternoon for a walk, isn't it? It's so quiet, it seems almost like Quincy. Let's pretend we're on a vacation.
All right, we're miles away from Philadelphia. And...
Mr. President.
Well, we didn't get very far with that. What's the matter? What is it?
Mr. President. Oh, thank heavens I found you. Good afternoon, Madam President.
Hello, Mr. Wilker.
What's happened?
Insurrection in Pennsylvania. Guns, regiments, John Freeze.
What?
Now, wait a minute, Walcott. Wait a minute. Slow down. Catch your breath.
A man named John Freeze is leading a rebellion against the government.
Against the government?
Well, against the new federal property tax.
Oh!
Freeze and his rebels say if any tax collectors come into Pennsylvania, they're going to shoot their legs off.
Oh,
well,
my.
Well.
Yes. But that isn't the worst that's happening, Mr. President.
No?
No. The women are in this, too.
What?
Any tax assessor who knocks on any front door in Pennsylvania is liable to get a bucket of boiling water dumped on his head by the lady of the house.
Oh, my.
Yes, they're all keeping the kettles boiling just in case. Several federal men have been treated already.
A hot water war, eh?
Oh, can you imagine boiling water, Mr. President? We've got to take steps immediately.
All right, I'll call a cabinet meeting.
Well, I took the liberty of calling one already, sir.
Oh, you did?
Yes, the gentlemen will be assembled by 3:00.
Very well, I'll be there. Gentlemen, I want an order sent out telling the people of Pennsylvania they must submit to the laws. And I want General McPherson and a force of cavalry and militia to proceed to Pennsylvania immediately. I want this rebellion brought to an end at once. And I want John Freeze arrested.
It's late, Mr. President.
Yes, I know.
Has something else happened?
They captured John Freeze. He's been brought here for trial.
Well, that's what you wanted.
But you have to have order in the land.
I know.
And yet there is sympathy in my heart for John Freeze. He's being tried for treason, but I don't believe he's a traitor. This country is going through a spell of growing pains. There's bound to be belchings and disorders if all the laws don't digest properly. It takes time.
Well, I'm sure you'll arrive at what's right to do about it.
Well, we must have order in the land. There's no question about that.
Is there any word from the commission that went to France?
Yes, a dispatch today. Talleyrand has refused to receive our envoys unless they pay heavy bribes to the French officials. He also wants America to make a large loan to France.
What are you going to do?
I've done it. I sent a message to Congress saying the mission to France has failed, and I've asked that we speed our preparations for war. Oh, my dear, I don't want war. I don't want war at home with the giant freezers. I don't want war abroad. That's all I see before me. That's all I see before me.
In just a moment, we'll come back to Edward Arnold and Mr. President.
Today, there's a dangerous killer on the rampage throughout the country. The killer's name is tuberculosis, better known as TB. However, the picture is not as bleak as it looks. Although TB causes more deaths among persons between 15 and 34 than any other disease, it is steadily being eliminated by public action. Scientific knowledge of the causes of tuberculosis and its methods of prevention has now made it possible to battle this menace. The most important method of prevention is the mass chest X-ray. If individuals take the necessary steps to detect and treat this disease, TB can be wiped out. That's why those ill with TB must be found. So protect your own health, as well as your family's, by having your chest X-rayed immediately. Now, back to Edward Arnold and Mr. President.
Have you guessed who the president was when all this happened? It really did happen, you know, a few years ago. The president sent Congress the dispatches of the envoys telling of their demands for money. The letters were published and the country's anger blazed to warlike glow. Marshall and Pinckney returned from Europe completely discouraged. Gary remained in what seemed to be a vain hope. The president, desperately desiring to keep the peace, walked the tense, worried months.
Mr. President.
Yes, Mr. Hamilton.
The Federalist Party considers war with France the only course that can be honorably followed.
I don't want war, Mr. Hamilton.
How long do you expect this country to go on taking the insults it has been taking?
I can ignore insults very easily, but I know I'm saving lives by ignoring them.
An attitude like that could lose this country for us.
Mr. Hamilton, you forget that I know something of wars myself. Our minister at The Hague, Mr. Vance Murray, is keeping me informed of events in France. And so far, they are playing just as much of a waiting game as we are. I don't think Talleyrand wants war.
Well, he's liable to have one on his hands whether he wants one or not.
Mr. Hamilton, I do not intend to be dictated to by you. You were not elected to the office of president, and you're not responsible to the people. I am. I am responsible not only for what I do, but I'm sorry to say I am responsible for what you do. There will be no war with France, Mr. Hamilton, if I can prevent it.
Mr. President, the commanding general of the army sent you my name along with Pinckney and Knox to be one of his general officers. May I ask if you have removed my name from the list?
No, I have not. I sent the list to the Senate for confirmation just as I received it from the general.
Thank you, Mr. President.
But I still say, Mr. Hamilton, there will be no war with France.
Again. My goodness, you've practically demolished a whole tree. What on earth has the cabinet done to you today?
How did you know it was the cabinet again?
Well, I've learned to recognize the symptoms. If you don't get a change of cabinet soon, we aren't going to have a tree left on the grounds. What happened?
Well, two of my cabinet members persuaded the general to give Mr. Hamilton first place in his staff of officers. Against my recommendations.
I thought you passed the general's recommendation for Mr. Hamilton for the staff.
I did, but not for first place. Oh, that was my cabinet's idea, and there's nothing I can do about it now. The general has a right to choose his staff, but I must say this is a great triumph for Mr. Hamilton.
Mm. Oh, I came out to tell you it's time for you to leave for your cabinet meeting.
No, is it? Well, I'd better hurry. This is an important one. I have to tell them what I've decided about John Freeze.
Was he sentenced?
Yes. The word just came. John Freeze has been sentenced to death for treason.
Mm-hmm.
gentlemen of the cabinet, I intend to pardon John Freeze.
Why, you can't mean that, Mr. President. Why, John Freeze is a convicted traitor.
I don't agree with you, Mr. McHenry.
But the man led a rebellion in Pennsylvania.
Yes, with a feather in his cap and his fife and drum corps wearing red, white, and blue cockades. Red, white, and blue, gentlemen. The colors of their country.
It was a rebellion no matter what colors they were wearing.
They marched as Americans in protest against attacks. If you'll recall, as Americans, we too once staged a rebellion in Boston Harbor in protest to attacks.
But that was an entirely different matter, sir.
You mean to say, Mr. President, that Americans have the right to fight the tax collectors?
No, I do not. But this government is very new. We have to get our people used to the taxes and other things that go with government. It's our job to turn men like John Freeze into citizens. Gentlemen, let's not kill a good man because he didn't agree with the law we passed. Let's teach him why the law was necessary and get him on our side. I'm sure you must be able to see my point.
I agree with that at all.
Well, gentlemen of the cabinet, I'm sorry you don't agree with me. But John Freeze is going to be pardoned whether you agree or not. My dear, where are you?
I'm in here.
Well, I have news from France.
From Talleyrand?
Yes, the message came through Mr. Van Murray's at The Hague. He enclosed an official note from Talleyrand saying that if we would send a minister to France to straighten out the difficulties between our two countries, we would be received with all the respect due our country.
Oh, that's wonderful. Then there's hope for peace.
And Mr. Gerry has arrived back in this country with very much the same thoughts.
Are you going to call a cabinet meeting?
No. I've had numerous cabinet meetings on just the possibility of this taking place. My cabinet is completely under the domination of Mr. Hamilton. And Mr. Hamilton wants war. So I'm going to sidestep the cabinet completely. I'm going to send a message to the Senate announcing the appointment of a new minister to France.
Without consulting anyone?
Without consulting anyone.
Good for you. Who are you going to appoint?
Vans Murray. He seems to have the best contacts in France. I'm going to send a committee with him, but I won't announce that. I'll just send the Senate word of the appointment, and then we will hear from Mr. Hamilton and the cabinet.
Why, this is the most outrageous action that has ever been permitted in this country. How dare the president appoint a minister without consulting his cabinet?
It's absolutely unbelievable. Why, Mr. Hamilton would have conquered France. The president has ruined all chance of war.
The president's ruined the Federal Party. Why, our whole policy has been war with France. And now he's going to force peace on the country. It's betrayal, that's what it is. Betrayal.
And the newspapers. Have you read the newspapers?
I certainly have.
The newspapers are all in favor of the president's act. There's nothing Mr. Hamilton or even Congress can do in the face of public opinion. We have got to have peace whether we want it or not.
Well, he certainly let his cabinet down. No matter how you look at it, he certainly let his cabinet down.
Mr. McHenry and I thought I might as well discuss this matter with you first, as taking the matter in alphabetical order, you come ahead of Mr. Pickering.
Yes, Mr. President?
As you know, the former president appointed you to my cabinet.
That's quite correct, sir.
This is a somewhat painful duty that I had hoped to avoid, but I've come to the conclusion that I cannot avoid it. To put it bluntly, Mr. McHenry, you and certain other members of my cabinet have repeatedly opposed my policies. You have constantly kept Mr. Hamilton informed of everything that went on in the cabinet meetings. I find I can no longer put up with these actions, and I must ask for your resignations at once.
You shall have my resignation in the morning, sir.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Pickering, but I must ask for your resignation.
I will not resign, sir. I refuse to go voluntarily.
Very well, Mr. Pickering. Then consider yourself dismissed.
I heard the wood chopping and I thought you were at it again.
No. I was just watching the hired man do it. You know, it's a good feeling not to have to do it yourself.
You don't think you'll be doing any more wood chopping?
No, I hope not. The situation is settled with France. I've made the new appointments to my cabinet and Mr. Hamilton has become very quiet. I don't think there'll be a war now. No, my dear, I hope that I won't be doing any more wood chopping for the balance of my administration. I even think you and I might find time to spend a few weeks in Quincy. You know, it's kind of nice to be president when the smoke of battle clears away. Well, I'm sure you figured out by now who the president was when all that happened, because it really did happen, you know. And you'll have the answer in just a moment.
Remember John Steinbeck's memorable drama of Mice and Men? That's the outstanding dramatic treat in store for you tonight when the curtain goes up on Theater Guild on the Air. And as the stars, you'll hear Burgess Meredith and June Havoc. Adapted by Steinbeck from his novel of the same name, Of Mice and Men tells the story of two migratory farm workers who dream of owning their own ranch. They manage to save enough money for the ranch when disaster overtakes them in the guise of a woman. Burgess Meredith will reenact the role of George, and Miss Havoc will be heard as the woman who brings chaos into his life. That's tonight, when Theater Guild will present Of Mice and Men over most of these same ABC stations. So be sure to listen. Now here again is Edward Arnold.
Is all this wood chopping.
Oh, hello, Mother.
Now, dear, we're thinking.
I'm very fond of these trees in Quincy. Couldn't you and John Quincy choose some other form of thinking?
My dear, you've been the wife of a president. How would you like to be the mother of one as well?
Well, I would naturally be very proud.
Well, John Quincy is going to remain in this country now, and I think he's going to have a very sound political career. He's a real chip off the old block.
Oh, I wish you'd keep your mind off chips and trees.
Being president is a mighty big dream, Father.
Well, you're your father's son, John. You can do it. And someday I should be very proud to say I'm the mother of President John Quincy Adams and the wife of President John Adams.
Yes, it was John Adams who had such trouble with the cabinet appointed by George Washington, and who wrote years later, "I desire no other inscription over my gravestone than here lies John Adams, who took upon himself the responsibility of the peace with France in the year 1800. Be with us again next week, won't you, for another exciting story that happened in Washington a few years ago to Mr. President. Goodbye.
Edward Arnold appeared by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and can currently be seen in Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's Technicolor musical, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, starring Frank Sinatra, Esther Williams, and Gene Kelly. Mr. President was created by Robert G. Jennings. It was produced and directed by William T. Johnson. Today's story by Gene Holloway was based on incidents in the life of President John Adams.
Be sure to listen again next week when the American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations bring you Edward Arnold with another interesting and factual story of Mr. President. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Mr. President, on Tuned to Yesterday from May 9, 1948 on ABC with Edward Arnold. Betty Lou Gerson, who played Secretary Sarah, would actually do the same in all of the broadcasts, as the voice of reason or an anchor for the president, who the listener was kept in the dark about until the end of the broadcast. It's an hour of true history. On Tuned to Yesterday, I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for the series, The American Trail. This is the first broadcast in a series released by the Ladies' Auxiliary of the Veterans of Foreign Wars from February 6, 1953. The story called Dispatch to New York.
American Trail. The American Trail. Blazed in blood, defended in blood. Chapter 1, Dispatch to New York. 1776.
There is no longer room for hope. If we want to be free, we must fight. I repeat, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and the God of hosts is all that is left to us.
In 1787, almost 9 years later, a stagecoach hurtled along the rough lanes that led from New York to Virginia. Inside the coach sat Tom Farrell, a newspaper reporter from New York City. As he sat there, he planned how he would write the story he would soon send back to his newspaper.
Dispatch to the New York Packet. Dateline, March 18, 1787. Your humble servant, being considered by his betters, fit to report the events to occur in Philadelphia in May of this year, and having at his disposal a few weeks to spare, is now taking opportunity to travel by stagecoach to Virginia, there to interview one Patrick Henry, an aggressive opponent of the new American Constitution. Sir, do I have the honor of addressing Mr. Patrick Henry?
You do.
I'm Tom Farrell, sir, a journalist from New York.
New York, eh? Well, I can't blame you for wanting to come to Virginia. Sit down.
Thank you, sir.
And let me tell you something. I'm not an overly cautious man, so you'd best mind what you ask me and speak up while I pour a glass of cider.
Sir, is it true that you oppose the signing of the Constitution?
It is.
Would you care to say why?
Not at all. The 13 American colonies did not wage a bloody war to win their independence from a foreign king in order to calmly surrender that independence to a central government. It's this idea of one central government ruling all 13 states that I oppose.
But, sir, Virginia would be represented in the central government.
We want independence, not representation. And I'll oppose this Constitution with as much vigor as I oppose the royal crown.
The Constitution had not yet been approved or signed. It was still just a piece of paper. And Patrick Henry, in opposing it, was asserting his right as a free man to express his own personal opinion of the most important issue of his day. On the way to Philadelphia, newspaperman Tom Farrell became friendly with one of the delegates who was also traveling to the convention where the Constitution would be debated and signed. Signed, that is, if a sufficient number of delegates approved it.
Newspaperman, eh?
Yes, sir.
Well, what do you think about this Constitution?
Well, I don't really know.
You don't know. Of course you don't. Nor does anybody else in their right senses.
Well, it's pretty much the first time in history that people have been able to assemble and decide for themselves what kind of government they want to live under. You can't deny that.
Why do we need any government, eh?
Don't you think we do?
I'm Western Pennsylvania. Why should we pay taxes to anyone outside Pennsylvania? Mark my words, there's going to be a sack of trouble in Philadelphia. There'll be blood spilled.
There's some being spilled now. Listen.
Men who but a few short years ago had fought shoulder to shoulder for independence were now shooting at each other across disputed state lines. Tom Farrell knew that America could not survive unless all the states were united under one central government. A few days later, Tom Farrell sat in one of the crowded taverns of Philadelphia with the delegate who had been his stagecoach companion.
Look around, Mr. Farrell. Did you smell trouble?
I was looking at faces.
Grim faces, eh? Grim and serious. Not a smiling face here. Keep your eyes on yonder table. See the fellow with one hand touching the hilt of his sword?
I'd appreciate it if the gentleman seated opposite me would repeat his previous statement.
With extreme pleasure, sir. I'll repeat my statement and my intention, if need be, to defend it with my sword.
It is my contention that the southern states have no business joining a union, and that they should be separate and apart from your northern states.
Defend yourself!
A duel. Tom Farrell, watching the two men, sat there horribly fascinated. Two men slashing at each other with cold steel, fighting to the death over a piece of paper that the Founding Fathers hoped would bind together 4 million people. It was night, and Tom Farrell walked alone. He walked until he found himself in the ghostly silence of the Philadelphia waterfront. He wanted to think and to be alone.
Good evening to you, sir.
Huh? Oh, good evening.
A real bit of pleasure seeing a living soul down here.
Like a graveyard.
Aye, lad. It's dead all right. Look for yourself. American ships, a good dozen of them lying there idle, empty of cargo, and their timbers are rotting.
But why? Why aren't they loading cargo and sailing?
You should know that, lad. Foreign countries will have nothing to do with us. In their eyes, we're not a proper nation. They didn't recognize us. Now, what is General Washington going to do about that, sir?
I don't know. I wish I did.
What about those other fellas? Madison, Monroe, Hamilton, all the rest of them. What are they going to do about American ships lying idle?
Yes, what were they going to do? These men who had framed the new Constitution. In early May, Farrell was granted an interview with a very old but a very great man, who had seen more of the world than any other living American statesman of his time.
So you write for a newspaper, eh, boy? Well, I do a little writing myself. Here, let me pour you some tea.
Thank you, sir.
And make yourself comfortable, Tom.
Sir, I was just reflecting. When I'm married and have children, it'll be something for me to talk about. Drinking tea with the great Benjamin Franklin.
Oh, you better keep it to yourself. They're calling me an old fool, saying I'm in my second childhood. They say I'm too old and know what I'm doing. Confound me, Tom. I'm not a day over 80.
Pardon, sir?
Well, let's say 81.
You look just fine, Mr. Franklin.
I do, don't I? Now look at this new coat of mine, tailored in Paris. First time I've worn it since I came back from Europe.
Elegant, sir. Extremely elegant.
Well, now you have some questions, I suppose. Fire away.
Sir, are you satisfied with the Constitution in its present form? After all, it isn't the way you originally drafted it.
No, it isn't. I must confess there are several parts of it that I don't approve. But a document of that sort cannot please everybody. When you assemble a number of men to have the advantage of their combined wisdom, you inevitably assemble with those men all their prejudices, their mistaken opinions, their local interests, and sometimes selfish viewpoints.
That's very true, sir.
But you know, Tom, it astonishes me to find this Constitution, with all its margins for error, so near to perfection. I believe we can build a fine nation if we follow this charter. And we must. The rest of the world is watching us.
Still not everybody seems to want it.
No, it has its enemies. But the will of the majority of people must be served. The majority, not a minority, must rule this land of ours.
But the will of the majority of the people did not concern the minorities who fought tooth and nail against the American Constitution. Just as today, when wicked groups in America would wreck our way of life. So in those days, there were those who were prepared to use any methods they could find to prevent the Constitution becoming law. And Tom Farrell, sitting in a tavern a few days later, was scared. Scared because all about him were men who plotted the downfall of the United States before they were united. And with him was one of these very men, the delegate he had met on the stagecoach.
I've something to tell you, Mr. Farrell.
Oh?
Well, look who's here and just about to leave. Alexander Hamilton, mixing with the common people. Stop him and ask him what he thinks about the Constitution.
Excuse me, Mr. Hamilton.
Can I be of help to you?
Questions are at mine. I'm Farrell of the New York Packet.
Ah, yes. What can I do for you, Mr. Farrell?
Tell me, sir, do you think you'll get enough votes to make the Constitution law?
I don't know. But I know this. If we fail to win support for it, America will again become a colony and be ruled over by an English viceroy. Is there anything else?
No, sir, nothing. Thank you, Mr. Hamilton.
Well, it's a fine story that fellow Hamilton would have us believe.
You were going to tell me something.
Listen to me. Me and those who think like me, we found a way to prevent the Constitution from being signed.
A way to prevent it?
The Constitution cannot be signed until a vote has been taken to approve what it says. You understand?
I understand.
Now, as you doubtless know, the vote cannot be taken unless, mind you, unless 45 members of the convention are present on the floor.
I see. Yes, I think I understand.
It's simple. Enough of us intend to stay away from the convention just to make sure there will never be 45 members present. So no vote will ever be taken. The Constitution will have to be tossed out. You look impressed, Mr. Farrell.
I say, here, you hold on.
You mongrel and those like you.
What?
You... To oppose the Constitution is your right, but it's not your right to sabotage it. It's not your right to prevent other men from expressing themselves. You're a foul swine, sir. Your place is at the convention, and I'll be one to see you go there.
Now, see here, you...
Listen! Listen, all of you. We're going to need 45 delegates at the convention. Now, who's with me? Grab every delegate here in this place and drag them to convention hall.
You'll not drag me anywhere. You'll not ram this Constitution down our throats.
You'll be there.
I'd like to see you lay your hands on me, sir. Oh!
You'll be there, sir.
There were a score of divided opinions, but the majority of the men wanted to see the Constitution voted on. They took hold of the rebel delegates there and dragged them all the way to the convention hall to make sure the required 45 delegates were present, enough to take a vote one way or another. The Constitution faced life or death. For the first time in many long weeks, there was a silence at the convention. And General Washington, the man who had led American troops to victory in the Revolutionary War, faced the assembly.
We who are gathered here must now determine by a vote once and for all whether or not this document, called by us the American Constitution, shall decide for this generation and all those to follow a way of life dedicated to individual liberty and the security of all the states. We who have planned it have full knowledge that it may contain mistakes, and we have accordingly left the way open for future generations to rectify any of these mistakes to suit the times in which they live.
A few hours later, Tom Farrell wrote the final paragraphs of the story he would send to New York.
September 17, 1787. Dateline, Philadelphia. Dispatch to the New York Packet. Your humble servant, having witnessed the conclusion of the events in this city, is able to report that the American Constitution has been approved by a majority of the delegates sent here by the 13 states. All that is now left to do is for the states themselves to ratify and make the Constitution the law of the land. My last impression of it all is the look on General Washington's face. He did not seem to know what was going on about him at the last. He stared straight ahead, and one knew what he wanted. Will this Constitution succeed in uniting this country? Will it prevail?
You and I know it did. Oh, not without further warfare and human misery, but it did prevail. We are living proof of it. We who breathe the fresh air of liberty, whose fathers in every generation have stood ready to defend with their blood what we have in this country of ours. And we too stand ready. Aye, ready. And so you have heard the first chapter in the story of the American nation, brought to you by the Ladies Auxiliary to the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Next week, another story to make you proud of this great country of ours as we follow the American Trail.
The American Trail on Tuned to Yesterday from February 6th, 1953.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Knox Manning in Hollywood taking you on another brief journey behind the scenes. Once again, we draw the curtain to watch a fragment of forgotten drama, a story of people and places already hidden in the background of destiny. Today, we shall meet a young English noblewoman who suffered from an incurable malady. But first, a word from a familiar voice.
To close out this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday, here's Knox Manning from Behind the Scene, a syndicated series from the 1940s.
Step with me behind the scenes, back over 300 years to a quaint English harbor. The long row of white houses facing the cobblestone road, the gray sails on the miniature ships tossing in a lead-gray sky, and the foam of the waves beating in perpetual fury against the embankments, relentless as life or death. In one of the houses, a window is thrown open. Beside it, in an ornate canopied bed, a lovely young woman tosses, turns, and mumbles in her sleep. You can't understand the words she's saying? No, they're strange words of a foreign tongue. No one in the room can understand them, not even her handsome young husband, John, but each of them can read the heartbreak in her eyes. Lady Rebecca Rolfe was dying. She knew it now, had to admit it even to herself. She'd been dying for a long, long time, a little each day for the past 12 months. And only one person knew the cure, Lady Rebecca herself. She knew, she had known for a long time. At first, during those unbelievably exciting weeks in London when the new Lady Rolfe was the toast of the capital, the belle of every ball, she hadn't realized that the sickness had crept into her spirit. She'd been too busy. She'd learned to dance, the English dances. Had gowns that swept to the floor and whispered to her as she walked, jewels bright as sunsets to lie against her throat, sparkling even more in contrast to her dark complexion. She'd been received in every fashionable home. At first, as a stranger from a distant land, she felt the curiosity in their glance, the lifted eyebrow and the quizzical smile. But she'd won them over, won them all with her charm and exotic beauty and her youth. For Lady Rolfe was only 22, won them all, even the king. But in that very moment, as she curtsied on the polished palace floor, she felt the first symptoms of her illness. It was such a simple malady with such a simple cure, and yet the doctors didn't know it. Lady Rebecca was dying from homesickness. John had understood. He'd take her home. But it was too late. Before they reached the harbor, Lady Rebecca collapsed and was carried gently to the canopied bed in the White House overlooking the docks. It was too late. Lady Rebecca would never go home. The twilight breeze rustled the heavy silk curtains of the bed and far out in the harbor filled the sails of the tiny vessel that pushed into the horizon, the ship that carried Lady Rebecca's heart, but not her body, across the sea. Lady Rolfe sighed as she fell back against the pillows. Then she turned to her husband and forced her breath to shape the words in her new language. John, she said, John, I will never leave England now, never go home. I know that. I'm going to die. I know that also. I realize that soon I shall be forgotten by everyone except you who love me. And it's foolish to hope otherwise, but I wish that I might be remembered in my own land, remembered just a little in America, not as the fashionable Lady Rebecca Rolfe, but as the girl I was once, as the Indian princess Pocahontas. This is Knox Manning inviting you to join me again tomorrow at this time for another journey into that dim half-light where chance and destiny lift men out from behind the scene.
Behind the Scene with Knox Manning on Tuned to Yesterday, bringing to a close this hour of true history. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVanier. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back.